The council, as we just reported, heard from the restaurant and cultural committees about funding recommendations in the studio to discuss that and more. I have Summit County Councilmember Glenn Wright. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie.
So these are just recommendations. Will the council tweak anything between now and next week when you're scheduled to approve them?
I suspect we might, based upon the discussion we had last night. It's not something we usually do. I think both of these committees do just a terrific job. It's a thankless job to pour through all these grant requests, and they do a great job in trying to divide the assets that we have for these purposes. I think our discussion on Park City was a little unique, and I think we're looking to help Park City a little bit this year in particular, but I'll analyze the parade up maybe a little bit differently than the committee did. We want to make sure that whenever anybody comes to Park City or to Summit County, they have a good experience. And the funds that Park City requests really for organizing the event. If they can't do it adequately, and we have a lot of people coming into town and they get a sour attitude on it, then they don't come back again. And this is a pretty good moneymaker for businesses in Park City, particularly on those days every 6 or 7 years when the 4th of July parade falls on Sunday. And we're about the only 4th of July parade in the state. Remember the last time that happened, the 7-Eleven down on Park Avenue had the highest beer sales in the nation.
Yeah, so it sounds like you are going to give Park City some money?
We still have to discuss it.
Yeah.
Yeah. My looking into the crystal ball, with three of us speaking in favor of that, I suspect there's some votes there to tweak the process a little bit. And that's something we usually don't do because these committees just do a terrific job. But I think this is kind of a unique occurrence.
Right. So, they're asking for 2 years because they work on a two-year budget. But I'm just wondering, we could still just have a parade.
Yes.
Right? We could. And so, do we need to throw the big party for everybody afterwards? That would save a lot of money.
It would save a lot of money. It would also decrease sales. You know, the whole purpose of these grants are to increase business. You could look at it both ways. Do we want to have thousands of people coming into town on 4th of July, or would we want to have it be our own unique—
I don't know. You're still going to have thousands of people on Main Street for the 4th of July parade.
But I think we want to make sure that we do it right.
The committee wrote in the report that one factor in the zero funding was community concern over event fatigue. Is that a finding the committee can make?
They made that finding initially, and then they said they took it out. But certainly, if you talk to the community, event fatigue is an issue. You could say that about virtually any of the events that we have in town.
Right. And again, just to go back to it, it used to be back in the day, we had the parade. We'd all go down to the park and watch rugby. Right? It didn't have to be beer gardens and kids' rides and everything else. Mm-hmm. So are you going to recommend full funding? You had said that you would prefer to see some of the money shift from Sundance to the 4th of July.
We'll see whether it's full funding or not. I particularly picked on Sundance just because it was one of the larger grants. And to use kind of the same analysis, let's look at the marginal utility of a few extra dollars to Sundance compared to their overall paid media and their earned media that they get worldwide. I think within the film industry, everybody knows where Sundance is and when it is. And I'm not sure that the same amount of money spent on Sundance wouldn't help any of the other grant requests more.
Yeah, given that the Citizens Committee feels that Sundance has a higher return on investment, aren't there rules that this committee must follow, and that being one of them?
I think that's a judgment. They think that it has a higher return on investment. I question that particular judgment. As I said, because of the marginal utility that, say, $20,000 or $30,000 on the Sundance budget does compared to their overall media presence worldwide. I think it's a drop in the bucket.
So what's the return on investment then on the 4th of July celebration? Just beer sales?
sales from all of our Main Street and Park Avenue vendors.
But that would certainly still happen if just a parade was held.
It would happen probably this year. And if we don't do a good job and we start having events that people don't want to come to anymore, it could have long-term effects. Part of it is just to organize the parade and make sure it goes efficiently.
Right. I mean, I think lots of people just come for the parade, though. That's what
I guess
I'm trying to. And then it's like, because we're throwing a party, that's where they end up.
Sure. But let's say you can't get in town and you wait in line for hours and hours to come into town, and the bus service isn't working effectively, and the police aren't organizing crowds. And, you stand in line for hours to get food. Next year, you don't come back.
Some people would say that's a good thing.
Some people would.
Other than the Park City funding, how do you feel about the grants that were recommended for the restaurant tax and other cultural?
I think they're, like I said, both committees do a terrific job on that. And I hate to second guess them. As I said, this is, I think, a unique occurrence.
Let's see. Summit County has been invited to some kind of intergovernmental conference at the White House. Since all council members are Democrat, are you guys eager to go here?
We discussed that, and I'm not sure I remember how it turned out. I think Kim might be going. I personally couldn't go. I have some personal issues on that particular day. Roger's going to another event representing the county. I wasn't hearing a whole lot of people raising hands. I think Kim is going to take the bullet for us.
And in terms of what the conference is about, I mean, what are we going to get out of it by sending her?
I'm not sure. That's one of the issues we were reticent. Apparently, there's some type of county initiative. Is it a valuable initiative to us? Do we need to be there to hear about it? Is it a photo op at the White House? All to be determined.
All right. Some talk of a satellite campus for Utah State University here in Summit County?
It's one of the ideas I had that I thought might stimulate economic activity on the east side of the county, and particularly be related to our agriculture and forest activities out in that area. Kim and I will be having some discussions with USU at tomorrow, actually, to see if it's something they're interested in. We'll put forward some ideas on what we think might be done there, see if they have an appetite for it. I've had some very, very casual conversations on that with a few people from USU, and there seems to be interest there. Certainly, it'd be great to have a satellite campus for local students. We have a lot of our local students go to USU, and if they could attend some of the first and second year courses right here in town, I think it would be an enormous benefit for our students.
Now, there used to be and several classes offered through the USU Extension Service. Is that bygone?
I don't know.
Because I know I've taken some of them, out in Oakley.
I'm not exactly sure. Certainly the extension still does courses. But I was thinking more of straight undergraduate courses like the UVU campus in Heber, where maybe some of our high school graduates, they don't have to, move to Logan to start off their academic career, and they can start their courses right here in town. Could save them a lot of money.
You recently met with Rocky Mountain Power to discuss a few green ideas. One possible item for the future, how can a charged-up electric car actually supply electricity for a house?
And that is a real future idea that I think will definitely occur. And encouraging that and kind of quickening that progress could be useful for a lot of reasons. Number one, typically, these fully electric cars have a 60 to 80 kilowatt hour battery. I look at my electric consumption. You can probably look at yours too, and you can probably run your house for 3 days on that. So from an emergency standpoint, it would serve as a great backup system. But beyond that, as we get more and more solar energy into the electrical mix, Rocky Mountain Power and really utilities nationwide have difficulty balancing the load as solar falls off in the late afternoon while demand is still high. For example, if half of our cars 10 years from now in Summit County were electric cars, and when people came home from work, they'd plug them back in. Yeah, now Rocky Mountain Power would have to adjust your rates so you have favorable rates during the day. They would actually buy back power from your car at a higher rate, and then you charge it up at night. For instance, maybe you get home from work at 6 o'clock, the demand lasts until 10, so you're sending power into the grid for 4 hours, and then you're taking power out of the grid for 8 hours to charge your car.
Yeah. So when you think about, something like that could happen, it's really just a kind of a wiring of the house, right?
It's mostly getting an inverter between your car and the system, and having electronic means to interact with Rocky Mountain Power. And this is something that utilities have done nationwide in terms of demand response for years. I mean, when I lived in Florida 20 years ago, I had demand response devices on some of my high draw electrical devices, so they didn't come on during some of the high peak periods. That's not particularly new technology. It's the concept of tying it all together and having a smart grid. Those are things that will help Summit County and Park City meet our renewable energy and carbon footprint goals.
And I was going to bring that up, given that both Park City and Summit County has some pretty challenging goals to meet here. What I haven't heard is anything in terms of what would happen with new construction. Nothing within the building departments that would say, every house has to be sited for solar efficiency or wired so that solar panels could be put up. Nothing like that. How come?
One of the obstacles we have is figuring out what we're allowed to do with the state building code. And those are some things that our planning department and the planning commission, I think, will start addressing this year. One of the concepts I got from Rocky Mountain Power is that they don't believe, their lawyers don't believe that requesting, having local requirements for electric heat pump service rather than gas service, which is a carbon footprint issue, they don't think that violates the state law. Now we're looking into that, and we'll see if that works out. But certainly, once you go down that road, there's some real economic benefits to actually making houses and all buildings more and more efficient. We had some of these discussions during the long discussions on the development agreement at the Canyons. And I think that's the place, if we can put in some very high efficient and carbon footprint positive measures into our building code, we have over 4 million square feet of new development there that is going to come online probably in the next 5 to 10 years. And that's the majority of the additional building that's going to happen in this side of the county. If we can really address those ideas before the construction gets started there, we can have a real leg up on our renewable energy and carbon footprint goals.
Yeah. Before you came on, I was reporting just the traffic congestion there due to the construction there on Highway 224, and I was kind of curious. Is the electric bus stuck in that traffic as well?
Yes. And that's one of the things that we're going to be seeing very shortly. I think we're going to have some individual briefings from Carolyn Rodriguez on the potential BRT proposals. A BRT system would eliminate those traffic delays for the electric bus system and make use of the system a lot more effective for people. They'd be zipping by people stuck in traffic. on 224. One of the questions I've already asked about that, how does that affect, you know, there would be some capital costs involved. I'm not sure what those are yet. We haven't had that full briefing. But there's federal money available for some of that. What are the O&M costs? And the O&M costs for BRT are similar or possibly less than what we're putting into the electric bus system right now.
Real quick, wanted to ask you, we've got a primary coming up June 26th. You're one of those who support the plan for voters to temporarily change their party affiliation. How come? Even Summit County's Democratic Party chairman doesn't support that.
Well, I think everybody has to make their own choice there. I would like to see both of the candidates for Senate 26 come from the Wasatch back. That's my main motivation in kind of proposing that type of activity. I don't think many people have done it. I talked to Ken Jones about that last night, and there have been very few voter registration changes. But the ballots are out now for both the Democratic and Republican Party because all the voters in Summit County have a choice in the primary at one race or another. But most of our voters are non-affiliated voters, and there's still an opportunity for all of those voters to take part in the election. If a non-affiliated voter wants a Democratic ballot, all they have to do is call the county clerk, and they will have one mailed to them, or they can show up at one of the voting centers and do that. If you want to take a Republican ballot, you actually have to show up in person. So at the early voting at the county courthouse or at the four day of election voting centers.
Okay. So can you tell us the county clerk's phone number? Do you have that on you?
I'd have to look it up on my phone right now.
I think it's, I hate to put it out. I think it's
435-336 and then four numbers
615-3302, I think. Anyway, the voting centers, where are those going to be? Marsac Building?
Yes, the voting centers on Election Day, Colville City Hall, Camas Service Building, Park City Municipal Building, and the Sheldon Richens Building.
So as a non-affiliated voter, I could go up and say I'd like the Republican ballot, and then I'd have to fill out some paperwork? Or
yes.
How does that work?
You have to change your registration, and you can either keep that or not.
Okay. And then if I wanted to vote Democratic
ask for the Democratic ballot.
In November?
No.
It doesn't matter?
For the primary. For the primary.
Okay.
Yeah. Non-affiliated voters can... Yeah. Voter party registration only applies to primaries. Everybody gets to vote in the general.
Okay. Glenn, anything else?
That's it.
All right.
Thanks for your time, Leslie.
It's been more than a year since the Park City Planning Commission had heard from the owners of the Kimball Garage. The conditional use permit, originally approved by the Planning Commission, was appealed by concerned neighbors, citing noise as one of the biggest concerns. After hearing the appeal, the city council remanded the project back to the Planning Commission. At last night's meeting, Planning Commissioners got another look at it. In the studio with me, I have the member of the Park City Planning Commission, Melissa Band. Good morning.
Good morning.
Now, you're one of how many Planning Commissioners who have seen this project before?
Commissioner Susser wasn't there last night, so I think that there were three of us.
Okay, so we're not starting from ground zero?
We're not really. I mean, we're looking at this. It's not a new application, and all of the new commissioners have all of the past information. But we've got some issues in front of us that need to be mitigated before we can do anything, and that's where we're starting.
All right. So the project was remanded from the city council. Were their directions clear enough then on what you need to look at?
Yeah, their directions were very clear. And I think we've had former commissioners on here talking about this. When we gave it a 6-0 vote, I don't know that we really looked at it closely enough. I think we all said we missed the mark on that. The Board of Adjustment had looked at it so closely, and I think the first time it came in front of us, it was like, oh, yeah, everybody's looked at this, and this seems good, and we passed it up. And City Council and the neighbors came out and brought up some very, very good points, and so it was sent back to us, and we started all over again.
So really, what has changed then between the last time it was approved and now?
I think what's changed is that, again, the neighbors and city council saw some huge issues. This isn't apples to apples to any other application we've seen before. It's not a tiny deck on a restaurant, and it will have some impacts on the neighborhood that we just had not considered.
The applicant, Tony Tyler, said last night that they have more than mitigated the criteria. Old Town resident John Staffschultz said during public comment they have not mitigated 12 of the commissions. What are your thoughts on that?
I think there are two major issues and that we really, really need to look at and are going to be tough to mitigate. Noise is one of them. I mean, we're in a valley here. Everybody knows noise travels upward. Anecdotally, anyone who's lived in Old Town can tell you that if they are up in a certain neighborhood, they can hear conversations very clearly on the deck of, say, the Spur. So noise traveling upward with 141 people being allowed on that deck, that could be pretty noisy. And then the second thing is loading in and loading out. Again, it's not necessarily like a restaurant where patrons come and go all night long. If there is an event there, within, I would say, 20 minutes, you're probably going to get the majority of those people coming in. And the occupancy for that event space is 480 people. That's a lot of people. Buses, Ubers, whatever, however people arrive, it's going to cause an issue. And so that is the other thing that we really need to closely look at.
I mean, it's at this point too late to like make some kind of load in, load out zone, isn't it? I mean, they've developed what used to where the deliveries used to come in, where.
Well, and we allowed them to do that. They built on it and they don't have to have parking because they've, like many people on Main Street, they chipped in on China Bridge. Also, I think that was always sort of a problematic area for the city anyway, because that curb cut was on Main Street. And that's just a tough corner. There is the parking in front. Right now it's being used for construction staging, but there are several spaces in front of Kimball Arts Center. I don't think that the city is really willing to give them that area as unloading and loading zone. So it will be tough.
One of the original appellants, Sanford Melvert, said during public comment that the noise study that the applicant had done was superficial at best, basically theoretical noise. I mean, can you imitate noise? I mean, I guess I'm just really confused. I mean, noise is noise, no?
Well, I looked at the study as well. It is theoretical. I'm not a sound engineer, so I would never comment as to how realistic that is. But I do think there was enough concern that we will definitely revisit that. We had our new city and engineer stand up and say that we probably need a third party. And I think everyone on the planning commission last night agreed that we need to look at that one more closely.
So does that mean it's another year then before we get the results of that study?
You know, I don't know. Honestly, I think that is probably a question for the city and the applicant. I don't know how quickly those things can be done. And I don't know if we're going to start with a new study or we're going to have a third party evaluate it. So I think it could probably be done far more quickly than that.
Yeah. The applicant wasn't thrilled about the request to pay for a parking study, which I guess the commission ultimately decided against. But will a study be done?
I think almost certainly some kind of study will be done. And I don't blame him for not wanting to pay for a parking study because he doesn't have to have parking. So that doesn't really make sense. But we do need some kind of a traffic study. It's not going to be your normal traffic study because, again, these are very specific concerns. We have basically loading and unloading. How are we going to deal with those issues when large amounts of people come at the same time? And it's a thoroughfare for people driving around as well as public transit.
Let's talk a little bit about the tent issue. There was some talk about perhaps putting up a tent on the roof as a way to help mitigate noise, and that's, we're not going to allow that anymore? Or?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think it was problematic because people were hoping that it would mitigate noise, but then it's also very visual, and one of the recommendations we had from the Board of Adjustments is to keep that area as not visible as possible. So a tent obviously is going to draw attention to itself. And I think there were too many issues there. So they just said, forget it. We don't need a tent.
All right. The applicant did invite the Planning Commission to come up for a site tour to see how things are shaping up and kind of get a sense of what they're talking about in terms of the event facility. When does that happen? You're all going to go, it sounds like.
Yeah, no, I think it's a great idea. I mean, honestly, site tours, the public are allowed. So if there are 30 or 40 of us standing up there on the deck, that might be really helpful as far as just knowing how far noise carries and we're talking. I would say they will tell us when we can. They'll schedule that with Bruce, and I'm sure it needs to not be a construction zone when we go up there as well.
Yeah. Anything in particular that you're going to be looking for?
Again, I think it's noise, and that will be very telling. And just to get a feel for the space up there, they've said they won't allow more than 141 people on the deck at any given time. And it's hard to imagine just driving past that 141 people are going to be up there anyway. So I think being up there with other people and just feeling how the space feels and how the noise carries while we're up there.
Yeah, in terms of just the timing on all of this, I mean, when do you expect to have some findings?
I think that depends on how quickly we get it back on the agenda and how quickly we get the site tour. The applicant is very motivated to get some findings that will allow them to operate the space, obviously, and they want to work pretty closely with the staff. It sounds like there's some of the planning commissioners are in favor of doing something that would maybe have them checking in or doing administrative conditional uses for each event until everybody's satisfied. So I think there's a way forward if everybody's willing to go that direction, and I'm not exactly sure what that's going to be.
All right. Well, L.L. Bean's supposed to move in, I think, this fall. How close are they to finishing the special event space above?
I think they're pretty much on the same schedule. So I'm sure, and I don't know this from the applicant, I'm just guessing, but I'm sure they were hoping to be up and running by this winter.
All right, let's take just a few minutes for the other agenda items, the land management code amendments. Anything big there?
No, it's just cleanup, really, at this point. And it seems kind of minute to us, but it really is the things that we're working on right now are the things that are causing the planning department huge headaches. And so they almost sail through with no discussion, quite honestly, but it makes their lives a lot easier.
Okay. And any news with regard to the Twisted Branch Road subdivision? We're talking about four plats here.
That was a continuation last night. So really, we are waiting for legal and all the powers that be to figure that out a little bit better before we look at it too closely.
All right. And then went ahead and ratified the King's Crown Development Agreement?
I was not there for that part of the meeting, but I hear that we did, yes.
Okay. Anything else you want to mention?
I don't think so.
Melissa, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Park City Planning Commissioner Melissa Band. It's the Local News Hour on KPCW. KPCW News Time now, 8:47. Good morning, I'm Leslie Thatcher. Well, the Park City Historical Society presenting its annual historic home tour. That's going to happen next Saturday, June 23rd, in the studio. With details, Museum Director Sandra Morrison, good morning.
Good morning, Leslie.
So as I mentioned, June 23rd, how many homes you've got on tour?
So we have 8 homes on the tour this year. Our tour headquarters will be at the Townliffe Plaza, and then the homes are all centered around 8th Street. On Park Ave, Woodside, and we even have one under construction up on Norfolk Avenue. So it's a really small walking distance, and of course, taking off from the Townliffe Plaza, you can just go straight across the bridge. And the first house is Wilma and Ted Larimore's house right there on the ski run that we've all skied by, and it's just a gorgeous big yellow, and we're so pleased to have that on the tour this year.
Yeah. So what is it that you go out and ask individual homeowners?
We do. We walk around the neighborhood and we knock on the doors and we talk to people, and I'm just always overwhelmed that people are so interested in the historic home tour and they're willing to open their house and let us go inside. And basically, we're just being nosy, see how the other half lives in Old Town.
Yeah. So, I mean, what's to have your home as part of this tour? I mean, what do you require of them?
So the tour is from 10 until 3. So basically, we ask, you know, if people will open the doors. And most people hang out at their home and talk to people. And they just love the fact that everybody is appreciative that they've gone to the extra effort of maintaining and preserving a historic home in Park City.
Yeah, do you put any paper or plastic down on the floors?
We give booties to everybody to wear. So they all, you know, it looks like we're the surgical team walking around the neighborhood for a day. But, yeah.
Okay. How many tickets can be bought at the day of? Or?
Right, yeah. So we have tickets online right now at our website, which is parkcityhistory.org. And then we do sell them on the day of the tour. But, of course, that means you're standing in line. So it's faster if you buy the ticket online beforehand.
Okay. And they're how much?
And so the tickets are $20. And then we do offer members of the museum a discount.
All right. And then how long does it usually take somebody to get through eight houses?
Most people spend about an hour and a half. And so, you know, the biggest times are sort of 10 o'clock in the morning and then, you know, don't come. We close at 3. So really, you can, you know, 2 o'clock's about the last time that to buy a ticket to have enough time to see everything. Yeah.
Yeah. And what do people look at? I mean, are they just interested to see the design of what the furnishings, or is it just the historical aspects?
Yeah. I mean, some of them, you know, the insides are actually really quite modern and contemporary. You know, some people just have fabulous artwork. And then the really interesting one is, you know, these houses are small. So just figuring out the storage and just, the creative design, because they're just unique and interesting spaces. There was one house we had that in the bedroom, she had built a bookcase, but it was for all her shoes. So it was like this decorative of all her shoes on the wall, floor to ceiling. And she even had a ladder like you'd see in a library that ran across the track so she could get the shoes off the top shelf.
Yes. So do you have museum staff or volunteers at each house maybe to talk about the historical aspects?
So we have about 50 volunteers actually to put the event on. And so typically 2 at each home. And we do a lot of research. And so museum staff, Mahala Rudell, our research coordinator, and then David Hampshire have done a lot of research. And we give out a program with a short history of every house in the program, but a lot more information at the homes. And we ask the homeowners as well, you know, if they have any photographs of the renovations and any interesting things that they found while they were doing the work, or unusual stories about, you know, the furnishings in the house as well. And as I said, a lot of the homeowners will be around that day, and just they just love sharing their homes.
Okay. Again, people can get tickets day of, but you recommend getting them online beforehand. All right. And then in terms of your new exhibit, what have you got up?
So we are just about opening up our new exhibit, and it's called Once Upon a Playground. And basically a combination from a modern-day photographer and then the curator from the National Archives, and they got together and put together this exhibition about what playgrounds look like today, but what they looked like, you know, in the 40s and 50s. And there's actually some information about the earliest playgrounds got started around the turn of the last century. You know, before that, with no child labor laws and kids working, there really weren't playgrounds. It was just kids outside. And so it's, you know, it's an interesting visual exploration of playground equipment and how it's changed. And of course, you know, the first playground equipment, you look at it and you're like, oh my goodness, you could die playing on
probably
that.
People probably did, yeah. So it's not open at it. I thought it, had a
yeah. So
the free day.
Oh no, we installed it this week.
Ah,
yeah.
Okay.
Yep. So it actually officially opens on Saturday, June 16th. But we have it close enough right now that people can sneak in and go and see it. Yeah. So and we've added a lot of interactive things for the kids to play with it as well. So you know, we have fun games like hopscotch and tosses and things.
You guys do anything for Savor the Summit?
So no. So we do have a couple of other things coming up as well, though. We're working on a new guided walking tour. The Main Street tours start on the 18th, and that's at 2 o'clock. So if you'd like to learn more about Main Street history, it's a guided tour, and we ride the trolley to the top of the street and walk down, so you don't have to be too physically fit for that one, but we're working on a guided tour of Park Avenue, and so the first one will be on June 19th at 11:30 in the morning. We're just going to do four of those over the summer. So we have June, July, and August, and if you go on our website, you can see the dates, the other dates for those. And then on the 21st of June, we have Rob Brook giving us another lecture, The Strange and Curious History of Alcohol on Main Street. And this is part two. So he gave us this talk when we had our Prohibition exhibition last year, and he's done a lot more research and has new and different stories. So that'll be at our Education and Collections Centre, and that's on Thursday, June 21st at 5 o'clock. And again, all this is on our website.
Okay, parkcityhistory.org.
Yeah.
Sandra, thanks.
Okay.